You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic and Republican lawyers for the House Intelligence Committee have spent 2 months now investigating the president's actions. Democratic committee lawyers used the hearing yesterday as a way to make opening arguments for impeachment articles. And a coverage note here, the chairs of the House investigating committees are expected to unveil articles of impeachment against President Trump at a press conference this morning. You can hear live NPR coverage starting at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. So did you follow yesterday's hearing? Did it help you understand the constitutional grounds for impeachment? What questions do you have about what happens next? We're at 800-642-1234. Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science, and she teaches American government and gender studies at the UW-Superior. Elisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me again.
So rewind on yesterday. Who testified and why?
We had Daniel Goldman, who was the counsel for the Intelligence Committee for the Democrats, and Barry Burke, who was the counsel to the Judiciary Committee for the Democrats. And then finally, we had Stephen Castor, who was the counsel for the Republicans on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committee. And so all three were testifying yesterday.
And so these lawyers, we heard, were representing Democratic members and Republican members of the House committees handling impeachment. Were their arguments political or partisan?
They have been arguing as the same as we've heard, I think, throughout the this entire impeachment hearings from the beginning. In terms of the Democrats' argument, basically they laid out the case that Trump violated the Constitution. And so there was, it was not necessarily political in nature, that they, you know, very much emphasized the violations to the Constitution and the interference with the 2020 election. There was some, clearly some partisanship on both sides. We have with Stephen Castor, basically just trying to sow doubt about Trump's intentions while he had done that. And so, again, we had the, you know, hearsay, presumption, no evidence claims over and over and over again. So it was definitely more partisan and more rancorous than perhaps it has been in the past. But both had very clear political aims and also partisan aims as well.
And we saw that staff lawyers cross-examined each other for the first time, which added a lot of tension to yesterday. What was that like?
So, I mean, with the first, if you remember way back, I know it seems like years ago, but one of the first impeachment hearings, I think the comments afterwards, how boring and dull they were and how, you know, these individuals testifying were just not very sexy and that, you know, enough for these to get the people's attention. And this one certainly was. So we had Barry Burke, who went up onto the dais, which had never happened before, and questioned Castor and really just very aggressively was throwing questions at him. And there was the Republicans tried to intervene with points of order, but the Democratic rules that have been established for the committee allowed that questioning to occur. And so everyone woke up after that one. That was very out of order, very different from what usually occurs.
We're talking with Elisa von Hagel. She's a political scientist and she teaches at UW-Superior. We are looking at what happened yesterday in the impeachment inquiry. Elisa, House Democrats are set to unveil articles of impeachment this morning. The details of those articles will be voted on by the entire House. How were yesterday's hearings important to what might happen in those articles today?
So in terms of what was heard yesterday, there was no mention of the term or the issue of bribery, which is one of the terms of impeachment or one of the claims that could be brought against the president in impeachment. There also wasn't significant mention of obstruction of justice related to the Russian election interference. And so it's presumed that those two issues will not be part of the articles of impeachment coming forward. Specifically, the focus was primarily on the obstruction of Congress, namely in the number of witnesses and the documents that weren't released that had been kept from these committees. And so that's supposed to be the primary articles of impeachment, as well as the abuse of power.
We had some talk leading up to the hearings in the Judiciary Committee about the Democratic chairman, Jerry Nadler, and his role in presiding over these hearings. How has he been? Because he denied requests for Republican witnesses.
Yes, that was also quite controversial. It was part of the rules that had been established by the, at the start of this entire impeachment investigation. And so the House voted on the rules of proceeding way back in October. And so that was part of the rules. And it was, again, there were throughout the entire day, you heard questions about where Adam Schiff was or where the whistleblower was. And so they were, the Republicans definitely hammered against or hammered back against those rules and were continuing to question why their witnesses that they had requested were not allowed to attend or were not to attend in attendance. But again, it was according to the rules.
So if articles of impeachment are laid out today at a press conference here at 8 o'clock, what does that mean going forward? What is the next step?
The next step is that the House Judiciary Committee itself votes on the articles of impeachment, whether or not to move it forward to the full body of the House. And so if it's as it's presumed that the Judiciary Committee would vote it out of the committee, then it would eventually make it to the floor of the House for a full vote. And there has been speculation that the full vote before the House is expected before Christmas. So and we, as we may have all heard, that the Senate has cleared their calendar for the start of the new year. So in January, they're sort of expecting or planning for these the trial, the impeachment trial. And so it looks like it's moving pretty rapidly at a rapid pace.
So,
at least for Congress.
For Congress, right. I mean, we've heard that it is moving rapidly, that Democrats are trying to move this process forward. What are we comparing that to? What is rapid?
I think compared to, usually we look to, there's not very many examples of this in history.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily it's, looking back at the Clinton and the Nixon example. And I think it's rapid in terms of it is a very short period of investigation time that the House Intelligence Committee was investigating. It was 4 years that the Kenneth Starr took to investigate President Clinton before coming to the House Judiciary Committee to drop charges of impeachment there. And so this is a really quick turnaround. Again, there's not a lot to compare it to, but at least for, in comparison to previous examples and, with respect to Congress, who's usually a little bit slower, it's they're attempting to move quickly because they know that the general public is starting to lose, or if they haven't already, are starting to lose, attention or focus to this issue.
Alisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. Coming up, UW-Eau Claire is adding 3 sports as part of an overall effort to increase enrollment and retention. We look at the influence of Title IX that requires women and men to get equal opportunities to participate in sports. Do you think UW schools should expand athletic programs? What questions do you have about Title IX? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about UW-Eau Claire expanding its sports programs. They're adding men's soccer and women's lacrosse. Men's baseball is coming back after it was discontinued in 1995. So this will make 25 athletic teams at UW-Eau Claire with more than 800 student athletes. Were you or are you a student athlete? In what ways did it define your college experience? Do you think UW schools should be adding more sports programs and building out their athletic staffing and infrastructure? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Dan Schumacher is Director of Athletics at UW-Eau Claire. He was named to this post in 2014, and previously he was Director of Intercollegiate Athletics at Chicago State University. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
So when you sought to add new programs to UW-Eau Claire, what was behind baseball, women's lacrosse, and men's soccer in particular?
Well, that's a twofold answer. Of course, when you look at the sports array that we were offering at the current time, we also examined where our top 20 feeder schools of enrollment sports module was at. And when you reflect on where our students are coming from general enrollment, one, baseball and men's soccer stuck out, that every single school that fed enrollment to the institution offered those type of opportunities. And a reminder that Division III is a non-scholarship intercollegiate athletic program. All of Division III is. Looking at it from an enrollment initiative and a cost value and return on investment, it's a little different than when you look at a Division II or Division I program because of the overhead of scholarships, maybe a larger geographic print for travel, things like that. So when we looked at that, and then we looked at the greatest emerging sport amongst NCAA all sports, women's lacrosse is the fastest growing sport in America right now, and has seen, we're out of 440 schools, almost 300 of them offer women's lacrosse now. So it was a very strategic move, both from an enrollment initiative. Of course, as you alluded to in your pregame before going on.
I've never had it referred to that way, Dan. but I'll take it. I'll take it. Carry on.
Title IX had to be addressed, and one of those things is, as I said, when we look at the top 20 feeder schools, everyone thinks of Title IX as proportionality. If you start a men's sport, you got to start a women's sport. Well, you know, the laws have changed over the last 40 years of Title IX and how you can become compliant with Title IX. And we lean on prong three. And I think any institution that has football, because there's no equivalent to football from a numbers standpoint, from a proportionality standpoint, prong three is about interests and abilities. And are we providing the experience and the offerings in the sports module that have our most interest from our regular student body? So we've been surveying our student body every freshman class for the last 5 years and dissecting that information along with looking at the enrollment initiatives. And a bigger thing is that come 2025, we're all going to be involved with an enrollment cliff, for a bad word to use, because the enrollment and the birth rates, by the time 2025 comes, it's going to drop off, where we may see close to 90,000, a little over 90,000 less high school graduates in the Midwest area. So that poses a challenge for every institution in the Midwest on where are we going to get our students to fill that enrollment.
We're talking with Dan Schumacher. He's Director of Athletics at UW-Eau Claire, and you can join in. Are you an athlete or a former athlete who plays baseball or lacrosse or soccer? What do you think about these sports and being added to UW-Eau Claire? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dan, going back to the federal gender equity law of 1972, Title IX requiring women and men get equal opportunities to participate in sports. The opportunity to play must be equal as well. How did that impact the ability to bring back baseball?
Well, we do have softball. So, you know, there is, you can look for it as a one-to-one. But again, getting back to that, there's a three-prong test. And prong one says that if you have proportionality, if you're going to lean on proportionality to abide by the law, that's considered prong one. Prong two has to do with propensity of an institution or a school expanding their athletic array And then number three is the interests and abilities. So there's three different ways. You only have to pass one of the three tests to be in compliance with Title IX. Now, again, most people go to Title IX, as you alluded to, because it's an equal situation. What we do is not only do we look at prong three for interests and abilities, but then we do involve making sure that every sport has exactly, you know, the same amount of uniforms, the same amount of facilities, locker rooms, you name it. So there's a total equitable student-athlete experience, no matter what the gender is. So it's a complicated situation, but I've had some general experience in past schools and past experience bringing it to Eau Claire, and it was a way that became, because we have other co-curricular activities that are going to be expanded as well, such as the marching band, such as academic programs. This is all part of a 400 student increase initiative in enrollment to start to prepare for 2025. So it's very strategic. And like I said before, this would be much more difficult to do if we were at a scholarship situation. Madison would have a harder time maybe doing this because of the dollars that would be involved to truly create an equitable situation.
Well, it seems like UW-Eau Claire is doubling down on athletics as a way to really help with student retention.
It is. We lead the student body in retention. We're at about an 89% retention rate overall. Regular student body is right around 81%. Our graduation rate is 87%, where it's a little bit lower, about 79% for regular students. So when you look at some...
And I think we just...
They are athletes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we lost you there for a moment. Carry on. Yeah.
Yeah, so because of that data of retention rates being so high and our graduation rates being high, compared to the student body, that data really tells a story that if we're going to bet on something, for lack of better terms, if you're going to bet on what's going to be a successful program to add to and for the enrollment initiative, athletics came to the forefront based on those data points, especially as it relates to having a successful student.
Nate from Stevens Point called in, couldn't stay with us, but Nate thinks athletic programs are important, that they encourage students to keep up their grades, and they create ways for students to maintain healthy social life while doing activities. Dan, where do you find the dollars in order to put up the coaching and the infrastructure and the staffing and the locker rooms and all of that that comes with adding sports and having 25 at your institution?
Well, it's based on enrollment. I mean, again, when we get back to there is no scholarship, so that's a large piece. When all of our student athletes have to pay full fees, full tuition. So our students, our regular student body and the student senate support us.
Oh, and again, I think, yeah, go ahead.
So, and so we had some segregated fees that are allocated to us from the student body. We also have tuition dollars that we generate from those sports that are allocated towards the overall budget to support the salaries and the operating costs. So it's a true business plan on how that works. And with us announcing these three sports, it's a two-year ramp-up. So we're going to have students on campus not playing yet, but paying tuition and fees and self-supporting their own programs that they're coming to play at.
Let's run this by you. Wisconsin lawmakers are working on a bill that would allow college athletes to profit from their status and hire outside agents beginning in 2023. What are your thoughts on this fair pay to play?
You know, I think it's going to become even more complex as we go along. The NCAA is naming three different committees for examining this initiative countrywide, how it's going to affect each division, Division 1, 2, and 3, Madison's issues compared to an Eau Claire or a Stevens Point would be different because I think the price point, we may have less than 1% of our student athletes, of the 800 student athletes we have, be affected by this, where you may have a larger percentage of 10, 15, 20% at a Madison for the Badgers. I mean, but I also think that there's going to be interesting ways for which recruitment of student athletes change, because we may not give out scholarships, but we may be able to entice a student athlete, for example, with a sponsorship from a local business, say our starting quarterback that we're recruiting for our football team, or the starting point guard or top swimmer. We're able to secure some local funding from a business where they are the pitch person for that business. And that has been illegal and not allowed in past years' practices. But that's just a small example. But it becomes a big example as we're competing against other Division III schools in the state of Wisconsin. Luckily, we're in a larger metro, more urban-type setting in Eau Claire, where it's a large population, and it creates more opportunity for Division III athletes than if you were, you know, maybe in Platteville, Wisconsin, or somewhere more remote. And so it's all the issues are different, but the NCAA is forming three committees to really look at where the issues are for each division.
Dan, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Dan Schumacher is Director of Athletics at UW-Eau Claire. Coming up, we look at gender equity in Title IX, pay equity, and the rights of college athletes. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk about the Fair Pay to Play Act and its repercussions right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the Fair Pay to Play Act here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. California passed legislation earlier this year allowing college athletes to hire agents and to make money through endorsement deals. The NCAA followed up by saying, you know what, we'll ask our athletic divisions to consider updates to bylaws and policies. Do you think college athletes should be able to make money through endorsement deals? What questions do you have about Title IX and the status of gender equity in college sports today? Are you or were you a student athlete? Is your sport supported enough by your university? What do you think about having earning potential? We're at 800-642-1234. Ellen Starowski is a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University, and her expertise is college athlete rights, Title IX, and gender equity. Her most recent book is called Women and Sport, Continuing a Journey of Liberation and Celebration. Ellen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, right now, college athletes do not receive any sort of payment for playing sports other than scholarships, if you look at it that way. But what do NCAA bylaws say about athletes receiving money for playing sports?
Well, I think in a nutshell, NCAA regulations largely prohibit athletes from receiving benefit from the use of their names, images, and likenesses, and engaging in endorsement deals. And so these recent legislative actions would allow athletes to realize their potential value in the market.
Does this loosening up, have you seen it coming over time? Has it been mounting, or was there ever a time where athletes could get paid?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, back in the day, back in the early 1900s, athletes did have the opportunity for tobacco deals on campus or to run franchises on campus. And Walter Camp, who was the father of American football, actually promoted that and made sure that his top players had the opportunity to make that kind of money. And so what we've seen over time is we've seen athletes' rights to basic economic equality gets stripped away by NCAA rules.
You've said that the NCAA has stonewalled the issue of whether to pay college athletes to play for years. What do you find troubling about the policies and bylaws you see right now?
Well, I think this is just a fundamental issue about economic fairness. Here we have a multi-billion dollar entertainment industry, which competes with professional sports in every respect, except for the fact that it precludes athletes from realizing their market value. And so what these legislative actions are doing is they're recognizing this economic unfairness and doing what should be done in terms of restoring to citizens the opportunity to reap the benefits of their work.
So California's Pay to Play Act goes into effect in 2023. Can you describe what this compensation means and how it's different from paying athletes to play sports outright?
Yeah. Effectively, the California bill takes us down the path of making progress on this issue by allowing athletes to receive endorsement deals outside of the athletic department. So if an athletic department has a deal with Nike, for example, an athlete would not be able to have that kind of endorsement deal with Nike, but they would be able to have deals with other entities, and they would also be able to have a deal, for example, with a gaming company, for instance. So that's effectively what the California bill is allowing athletes to do in 2023.
And gaming would be huge. I mean, that's a whole nother realm for what is possible when it comes to images and likenesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important that we be talking about this in this particular moment in time because, you know, we're now in an age where we have individuals who are social media influencers, and so many athletes at every level have the capacity potentially to really engage in that marketplace, and they're being restricted from doing so because of NCAA rules. So I think it's really wise for colleges and universities to take this moment and to really reexamine what they're doing, because this is going to happen one way or another, and it would be better, frankly, if they engaged in good faith to make this happen more seamlessly than what it is right now.
Does the NCAA have the power to take California's law or any other state to court if they don't like what they see?
Yeah, the NCAA has intimated that they might go to court with California on constitutional grounds. I think they'd argue a Commerce Clause issue where California can't impair the NCAA's ability to engage in interstate commerce. I think that's probably the argument they might make. But I think what's really interesting is the fact that there are 16 different states right now that either have a law that's similar to California's that's coming through or is anticipated. I know in Wisconsin there's talk about a law in your state. And of course, earlier in the week, Senator Murphy from Connecticut also announced that there's going to be a working group in Congress looking at this issue as well and looking at potential federal legislation.
We're talking with Ellen Starowski. She's a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University, where she studies gender equity, Title IX, college athlete rights, exploitation of college athletes. You can join in. Are you a coach? Could compensating athletes help attract players to your team? Or do you think athletes shouldn't be paid? Are you a parent of a college athlete? What rights should college athletes have? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ellen, what might this do to the pursuit of athletes to in terms of recruitment and keeping athletes? What might laws like this do?
Well, I think one of the reasons why so many states have begun to offer or put forward or talk about putting forward bills is that they know that there might be a recruiting advantage for schools in some states that allow athletes to do this and in other states where they don't. So I think there's a recognition of that recruiting advantage. But here's the thing, though. I think anytime we're confronted with something new, there's a lot of fear around what's going to happen. And the plain fact of the matter is that that there are already pay scales within the college sports system. There are full athletic scholarships versus partial athletic scholarships. Some athletes receive what are called book awards, where they only receive support for books. They don't receive a full scholarship. So it's not as if there isn't already this kind of arrangement within the system. And the system has been incredibly adept over the years at adjusting and adapting, and they'll do so with this as well. The fundamental issue here is that they'll just be doing it in a much fairer manner. In terms of empowering athletes and recognizing what those athletes mean to this economic system.
Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I as a season ticket holder to Badger football here in Madison, I think that after what I've seen going on over the last 20 years, pretty much everything is for sale at the university right now in terms of trying to produce more income for the university. Meanwhile, you've got these kids who are basically being exploited. Yes, they're getting their education and such, but oftentimes they don't have enough money to go out and live and, you know, have any kind of social life and things of that nature. I think the way the NCAA is going about this, though, is probably going to come back and bite them on the bottom. Because by bringing in the private sector, I think they're opening up a Pandora's box in terms of sponsorships that's going to only benefit the few, which what I think would be a better way for them to go ahead is to just admit that universities, at least the large ones in the Division I realm, are making hundreds of millions of dollars off of these kids, and they ought to just pay them some kind of decent stipend across the board so that they can reap some of the benefits from their work.
And I'll just add there, Steve, that UW-Madison was the 11th most profitable NCAA sports program in 2017 and to 2018 school year, raking in nearly $152 million. Ellen, your thoughts there on a across-the-board stipend?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciated Steve's comments. And here's the thing for me, that one of the reasons why the conversation is so fractured is that we don't have a group that is actually representing athletes. The NCAA and the conferences do not represent athlete interests. No one on the other side of the bargaining table that represents the interests of athletes. And so so his sensibility around, you know, well, what could be done collectively for athletes? A lot could be done collectively for athletes, but what has to happen in order for that to occur is there needs to be some kind of an athlete association that will do that. Because in the absence of that, it's just the NCAA negotiating with itself. And where I think this really needs to go is I think that we need to have players associations for college athletes that will negotiate out these kinds of rules that will create floors in terms of like basic provisions and then also allow for additional benefits depending on level and so forth.
We're talking about the future of athlete pay with Ellen Starowski as our guide. She's a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University. You can join in. Are you a parent of a college athlete? What rights should college athletes have? Do you support athletes receiving compensation? Do you support Wisconsin passing a bill to compensate college athletes? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Ellen Starowski here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we've been talking about college athletes and the Fair Pay to Play Act that prohibits athletic associations and conferences from denying athletes the opportunity to profit from their names, to profit from their images and likenesses. And this law is gaining traction straight across the country. Should institutions be putting more or less into their athletic programs, women's or men's programs, and who benefits? What do you make about paying college athletes? Join in 800-642-1234. Ellen Starowski is a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University, and she stays with us. So, Ellen, how could paying athletes impact Title IX and the gender equity law that we have today in sports?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think given the way that the California bill is written, it's the the arrangements would be outside of the athletic department and outside of the institution. So Title IX would not reach into those agreements. But the way that I think we should be thinking about this as we walk down this path is that I would argue there's an incredible amount of opportunity in terms of women's sports that that the system has not yet really capitalized on. And for example, if you look at an athlete like Caitlin Ohashi, Caitlin was the gymnast from UCLA who last spring just had this incredible performance. You know, she ended up getting an ESPY for best video moment of the year and best play of the year. And that video moment yielded over 100,000 views just last spring. Because of NCAA rules, she was not in a position to be able to benefit from that moment. And there are many, many other circumstances like that where I think female athletes have economic power that they're not able to navigate as a result of these rules. And frankly, I don't think that the system has been set up to unlock the power of that. So I think enabling athletes to have the capacity to go after endorsement deals will actually be a benefit and will lift up opportunities for women in sport.
Let's bring in Jamie now, joining us from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was a student athlete myself. I come from a long line of basketball coaches. It's not the profession I chose, but I'm still around it a lot. And I know you deal with gender equity in sports, and I'm glad we're having this movement towards fair pay and things like that. But I wonder if that might have a wider reach and a wider effect on things like retention on teams among women. I know that scholarships are often held over their head based on, you know, performance or any other issues. Coaches will often just clean house or get rid of a player if they did not fit with their team the way that they expected them to. There's not a whole lot of accountability on the coach's part. I didn't know with Congress taking this up and with more rights kind of being at the center here, if that might be something that would get attention too, if you had any insight on that.
I'm so, so happy that you raised this issue because I think the economic piece of this discussion is really connected to a much larger issue. And the much larger issue is that athletes really do not have the kind of power that they need to really operate within this domain. A previous caller referred to this system as being an exploitative system. And we do have female athletes who are really beginning to speak up about their own mistreatment. We've had case after case after case during this past year in particular. And this is where I think we need to acknowledge the fact that the entities that have directed the way that college sport has been built as an industry, the NCAA and the conferences, those are institutional entities. No athlete is a member of the NCAA, for example. And as a result of that, we really have this incredible imbalance of power. And that's where we really need to have a players association that can advocate for athletes and can really educate athletes about what the rules mean, what they're being asked to do, and also to provide avenues for them when things go awry, for them to have substantive representation to help push back against a system that otherwise is going to continue to roll over them unless that advocacy is in place.
We're talking with Ellen Starowski. She's a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University, where she studies gender equity and Title IX, college athletes' rights, and the exploitation of college athletes. Ellen, racial disparities exist in both professional and college sports. Do you think the issue of paying college players, what impact could that have on racial disparities?
Well, I think part of this discussion should be viewed as a civil rights issue. We do have, there's no question that we have in the top 1% that generate the most amount of revenue for the system. The top 1% of that workforce are predominantly African-American players, and we've got a power base which is white. And we know that we've had racial issues throughout the system for many, many years. And part of what is a part of this overall conversation is addressing all of these issues in tandem. So I think that we have a situation where we've become very, very accustomed to dictating to this largely African-American workforce what the terms and conditions are going to be that govern their lives, their safety, their access to education. And all of that needs to be unlocked. And that means access to power, both in terms of representation as well as money.
It's interesting, too, that you call this a workforce and not college, student athletes or college players. That's very intentional, I would imagine, that you are calling this a workforce.
Well, this is a workforce, and the NCAA has been working from the 1950s to the present to persuade us otherwise. They adopted the term student athlete to avoid having to pay worker compensation. That was an intentional PR decision on their part. And when you just look at the basic construction of what an athletic scholarship is, it's clearly compensation for performance on the field. So this all of these issues really are about work.
What happens when an athlete gets injured, gets hurt, cannot return to the field? Can they retain that contract, that athletic scholarship?
Yeah, you really need to read the fine print on this because in terms of the NCAA rules, there's one stipulation that says that an athlete cannot be let go from their team because of an injury, but you really need to look at what the terms are around that athletic scholarship and how long of a period it's awarded for. And typically those scholarships come up for renewal at the end of every year. So they may not lose that scholarship, in the weeks or months after the injury, but they may not be renewed after the term of that scholarship has come to an end. So athletes still do get dropped from their teams because they've been injured. And then, of course, what we also have is we have this whole healthcare crisis relative to athletes having to pay out-of-pocket expenses and long-term having to deal with health care costs associated with injuries that they've incurred.
Well, Ellen, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Kate, for the opportunity and for your callers.
Ellen Starowski is a professor in the Department of Sport Management at Drexel University, where she studies equity laws on women in sports, and her most recent book is called Women and Sport. Just ahead, the chairs of the House investigating committees are expected to unveil articles of impeachment against President Trump at a press conference here at 8 this morning. You can hear live NPR coverage right here starting at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.